sample can be assigned multiple labels. For instance, a given image may contain both a cat and a dog, and should be annotated both with the cat label and the dog label. The number of labels per image is usually variable. Scalar regression. A task where the target is a continuous scalar value. Predicting house prices is a good example. The different target prices form a continuous space. Vector regression. A task where the target is a set of continuous values. For example, a continuous vector. If you're doing regression against multiple values, such as the coordinates of a bounding box in an image, then you're doing vector regression. Mini-batch or batch. A small set of samples, typically between 8 and 128, that are processed simultaneously by the model. The number of samples is often a power of 2 to facilitate memory allocation on GPU. When training, a mini-batch is used to compute a single gradient descent update applied to the weights of the model. Section 4.2. Evaluating machine learning models. In the three examples presented in Chapter 3, we split the data into a training set, a validation set, and a test set. The reason not to evaluate the models on the same data they were trained on quickly became evident. After just a few epochs, all three models began to overfit. That is, their performance on never-before-seen data started stalling or worsening compared to their performance on the training data, which always improves as training progresses. In machine learning, the goal is to achieve models that generalize, that perform well on never-before-seen data. And overfitting is a central obstacle. You can only control that which you can observe. So it's crucial to be able to reliably measure the generalization power of your model. The following sections look at strategies for mitigating overfitting and maximizing generalization. In this section, we'll focus on how to measure generalization, how to evaluate machine learning models. Section 4.2.1. Training, validation, and test sets. Evaluating a model always boils down to splitting the available data into three sets: training, validation, and test. You train on the training data and evaluate your model on the validation data. Once your model is ready for prime time, you test it one final time on the test data. You may ask, why not have two sets, a training set and a test set? You train on the training data and evaluate on the test data. Much simpler. The reason is that developing a model always involves tuning its configuration. For example, choosing the number of layers or the size of the layers. Call the hyperparameters of the model to distinguish them from the parameters which are the network's weights. You do this tuning by using, as a feedback signal, the performance of the model on the validation data. In essence, this tuning is a form of learning, a search for a good configuration in some parameter space. As a result, tuning the configuration of the model based on its performance on the validation set can quickly result in overfitting to the validation set, even though your model is never directly trained on it. Central to this phenomenon is the notion of information leaks. Every time you tune a hyperparameter of your model based on the model's performance on the validation set, some information about the validation data leaks into the model. If you do this only once for one parameter, then very few bits of information will leak, and your validation set will remain reliable to evaluate the model. But if you repeat this many times, running one experiment, evaluating on the validation set, and modifying your model as a result, then you'll leak an increasingly significant amount of information about the validation set into the model. At the end of the day, you'll end up with a model that performs artificially well on the validation data, because that's what you optimized it for. You care about performance on completely new data, not the validation data, so you need to use a completely different, never-before-seen dataset to evaluate the model, the test dataset. Your model shouldn't have had access to any information about the test set, even indirectly. If anything about the model has been tuned based on test set performance, then your measure of generalization will be flawed. Splitting your data into training, validation, and test sets may seem straightforward, but there are a few advanced ways to do it that can come in handy when little data is available. Let's review three classic evaluation recipes. Simple holdout valuation, k-fold valuation, and iterated k-fold validation with shuffling. Simple holdout validation. Set apart some fraction of your data as your test set, train on the remaining data, and evaluate on the test set. As you saw in the previous sections, in order to prevent information leaks, you shouldn't tune your model based on the test set, and therefore you should also reserve a validation set. Schematically, holdout validation looks like figure 4.1. The following listing shows a simple implementation. This is the simplest evaluation protocol, and it suffers from one flaw. If little data is available, then your validation and test sets may contain too few samples to be statistically representative of the data at hand. This is easy to recognize. If different random shuffling rounds of the data before splitting end up yielding very different measures of model performance, then you're having this issue. K-fold validation and iterated K-fold validation are two ways to address this, as discussed next. K-fold validation. With this approach, you split your data into k partitions of equal size. For each partition I, train a model on the remaining k-1 partitions and evaluate it on partition I. Your final score is then the averages of the k-scores obtained. This method is helpful when the performance of your model shows significant variance based on your train-test split. Like holdout validation, this method doesn't exempt you from using a distinct validation set for model calibration. Schematically, k-fold cross-validation looks like figure 4.2. Listing 4.2 shows a simple implementation. Iterated k-fold validation with shuffling. This one is for situations in which you have relatively little data available and you need to evaluate your model as precisely as possible. I found it to be extremely helpful in Kaggle competitions. It consists of applying k-fold validation multiple times, shuffling the data every time before splitting it k ways. The final score is the average of the scores obtained at each run of k-fold validation. Note that you end up training and evaluating p times k models, where p is the number of iterations you use, which can be very expensive. Section 4.2.2. Things to keep in mind. Keep an eye out for the following when you're choosing an evaluation protocol. Data representativeness. You want both your training set and test set to be representative of the data at hand. For instance, if you're trying to classify images of digits and you're starting from an array of samples where the samples are ordered by their class, taking the first 80% of the array as your training set and the remaining 20% as your test set will result in your training set containing only classes 0 to 7, whereas your test set contains only classes 8 to 9. This seems like a ridiculous mistake, but it's surprisingly common. For this reason, you usually should randomly shuffle your data before splitting it into training and test sets. The arrow of time. If you're trying to predict the future given the past, for example, tomorrow's weather, stock movements, and so on, you should not randomly shuffle your data before splitting it, because doing so will create a temporal leak. Your model will effectively be trained on data from the future. In such situations, you should always make sure all data in your test set is posterior to the data in the training set. Redundancy in your data. If some data points in your data appear twice, fairly common with real-world data, then shuffling the data and splitting it into a training set and a validation set will result in redundancy between the training and validation sets. In effect, you'll be testing on part of your training data, which is the worst thing you can do. Make sure your training set and validation set are disjoint. Section 4.3. data pre-processing, feature engineering, and feature learning. In addition to model evaluation, an important question we must tackle before we dive deeper into model development is the following. How do you prepare the input data and targets before feeding them into a neural network? Many data pre-processing and feature engineering techniques are domain-specific. For example, specific to text data or image data. We'll follow those in the following chapters as we encounter them in practical examples. For now, we'll review the basics that are common to all data domains. Section 4.3.1. Data pre-processing for neural networks. Data pre-processing aims at making the raw data at hand more amenable to neural networks. This includes vectorization, normalization, handling missing values, and feature extraction. Vectorization. All inputs and targets in the neural network must be tensors of floating point data, or in specific cases, tensors of integers. Whatever data you need to process, sound, images, text, you must first turn into tensors. A step called data vectorization. For instance, in the two previous text classification examples, we started from text represented as lists of integers, standing for sequences of words, and we used one-hot encoding to turn them into a tensor of float 32 data. In the examples of classifying digits and predicting house prices, the data already came in vectorized form, so you were able to skip this step. Value normalization. In the digit classification example, you started from image data encoded as integers in the 0 to 255 range, encoding grayscale values. Before you fed this data into your network, you had to cast it to float 32 and divide by 255, so you'd end up with floating point values in the 0 to 1 range. Similarly, when predicting house prices, you started from features that took a variety of ranges. Some features had small floating point values, others had fairly large integer values. Before you fed this data into your network, you had to normalize each feature independently so that it had a standard deviation of 1 and a mean of 0. In general, it isn't safe to feed into a neural network data that takes relatively large values. For example, multi-digit integers, which are much larger than the initial values taken by the weights of a network. Or data that is heterogeneous. For example, data where one feature is in the range 0 to 1, and another is in the range 100 to 200. Doing so can trigger large gradient updates that will prevent the network from converging. To make learning easier for your network, your data should have the following characteristics. Take small values. Typically, most values should be in the 0 to 1 range. Be homogeneous. That is, all features should take values in roughly the same range. Additionally, the following stricter normalization practice is common and can help, although it isn't always necessary. For example, you didn't do this in the digit classification example. Normalize each feature independently to have a mean of 0. Normalize each feature independently to have a standard deviation of 1. This is easy to do with NumPy arrays. Handling missing values. You may sometimes have missing values in your data. For instance, in the house price example, the first feature, the column of index 0 in the data, was the per capita crime rate. What if this feature wasn't available for all samples? You'd then have missing values in the training or test data. In general, with neural networks, it's safe to input missing values as 0, with the condition that 0 isn't already a meaningful value. The network will learn from exposure to the data that the value 0 means missing data and will start ignoring the value. Note that if you're expecting missing values in the test data, but the network was trained on data without any missing values, the network won't have learned to ignore missing values. In this situation, you should artificially generate training samples with missing entries. Copy some training samples several times and drop some of the features that you expect are likely to be missing in the test data. Section 4.3.2. Feature engineering. Feature engineering is the process of using your own knowledge about the data and about the machine learning algorithm at hand, in this case a neural network, to make the algorithm work better by applying hard-coded, non-learned, transformations to the data before it goes into the model. In many cases, it isn't reasonable to expect a machine learning model to be able to learn from completely arbitrary data. The data needs to be presented to the model in a way that will make the model's job easier. Let's look at an intuitive example. Suppose you're trying to develop a model that can take as input an image of a clock and can output the time of day. See figure 4.3. If you choose to use the raw pixels of the image as input data, then you have a difficult machine learning problem on your hands. You'll need a convolutional neural network to solve it, and you'll have to expend quite a bit of computational resources to train the network. But if you already understand the problem at a high level, you understand how humans read time on a clock face, then you can come up with much better input features for a machine learning algorithm. For instance, it's easy to write a 5-line Python script to follow the black pixels of the clock hands and output the XY coordinates of the tip of each hand. Then a simple machine learning algorithm can learn to associate these coordinates with the appropriate time of day. You can go even further. Do a coordinate change and express the XY coordinates as polar coordinates with regard to the center of the image. Your input will become the angle theta of each clock hand. At this point, your features are making the problem so easy that no machine learning is required. A simple rounding operation and dictionary lookup are enough to recover the approximate time of day. That's the essence of feature engineering, making a problem easier by expressing it in a simpler way. It usually requires understanding the problem in depth. Before deep learning, feature engineering used to be critical, because classical shallow algorithms didn't have hypothesis spaces rich enough to learn useful features by themselves. The way you presented the data to the algorithm was essential to its success. For instance, before convolutional neural networks became successful on the MNIST digit classification problem, solutions were typically based on hard-coded features such as the number of loops in a digit image, the height of each digit in an image, a histogram of pixel values, and so on. Fortunately, modern deep learning removes the need for most feature engineering, because neural networks are capable of automatically extracting useful features from raw data. Does this mean you don't have to worry about feature engineering as long as you're using deep neural networks? No, for two reasons. Good features still allow you to solve problems more elegantly while using fewer resources. For instance, it would be ridiculous to solve the problem of reading a clock face using a convolutional neural network. Good features let you solve a problem with far less data. The ability of deep learning models to learn features on their own relies on having lots of training data available. If you only have a few samples, then the information value in their features becomes critical. Section 4.4. Overfitting and underfitting. In all three examples in the previous chapter, predicting movie reviews, topic classification, and house price regression, the performance of the model on the held out validation data always peaked after a few epochs and then began to degrade. The model quickly started to overfit on the training data. Overfitting happens in every machine learning problem. Learning how to deal with overfitting is essential to mastering machine learning. The fundamental issue in machine learning is the tension between optimization and generalization. Optimization refers to the process of adjusting a model to get the best performance possible on the training data, the learning in machine learning. Whereas generalization refers to how well the trained model performs on data it has never seen before. The goal of the game is to get good generalization, of course. But you don't control generalization. You can only adjust the model based on its training data. At the beginning of training, optimization and generalization are correlated. The lower the loss on training data, the lower the loss on test data. While this is happening, your model is said to be underfit. There is still progress to be made. The network hasn't yet modeled all relevant patterns in the training data. But after a certain number of iterations on the training data, generalization stops improving, and validation metrics stall and then begin to degrade. The model is starting to overfit. That is, it's beginning to learn patterns that are specific to the training data, but that are misleading or irrelevant when it comes to new data. To prevent a model from learning misleading or irrelevant patterns found in the training data, the best solution is to get more training data. A model trained on more data will naturally generalize better. When that isn't possible, the next best solution is to modulate the quantity of information that your model is allowed to store, or to add constraints on what information it's allowed to store. If a network can only afford to memorize a small number of patterns, the optimization process will force it to focus on the most prominent patterns, which have a better chance of generalizing well. The process of fighting overfitting this way is called regularization. Let's review some of the most common regularization techniques and apply them in practice to improve the movie classification model from section 3.4. Section 4.4.1. Reducing the network's size. The simplest way to prevent overfitting is to reduce the size of the model, the number of learnable parameters in the model, which is determined by the number of layers and the number of units per layer. In deep learning, the number of learnable parameters in a model is often referred to as the model's capacity. Intuitively, a model with more parameters has more memorization capacity, and therefore can easily learn a perfect dictionary-like mapping between training samples and their targets, a mapping without any generalization power. For instance, a model with 500,000 binary parameters could easily be made to learn the class of every digit in the MNIST training set. We'd need only 10 binary parameters for each of the 50,000 digits. But such a model would be useless for classifying new digit samples. Always keep this in mind. Deep learning models tend to be good at fitting to the training data, but the real challenge is generalization, not fitting. On the other hand, if the network has limited memorization resources, it won't be able to learn this mapping as easily. Thus, in order to minimize its loss, it will have to resort to learning compressed representations that have predictive power regarding the targets. Precisely the type of representations we're interested in. At the same time, keep in mind that you should use models that have enough parameters that they don't underfit. Your model shouldn't be starved for memorization resources. There is a compromise to be found between too much capacity and not enough capacity. Unfortunately, there is no magical formula to determine the right number of layers or the right size for each layer. You must evaluate an array of different architectures on your validation set, not on your test set, of course, in order to find the correct model size for your data. The general workflow to find an appropriate model size is to start with relatively few layers and parameters and increase the size of the layers or add new layers until you see diminishing returns with regard to validation loss. Let's try this on the Movie Review Classification Network. The original network is shown next. Now, let's try to replace it with this smaller network. Figure 4.4 shows a comparison of the validation losses of the original network and the smaller network. The dots are the validation loss values of the smaller network, and the crosses are the initial network. Remember, a lower validation loss signals a better model. As you can see, the smaller network starts overfitting later than the reference network, after 6 epochs rather than 4. And its performance degrades more slowly once it starts overfitting. Now for kicks. Let's add to this benchmark a network that has more capacity, far more than the problem warrants. Figure 4.5 shows how the bigger network fares compared to the reference network. The dots are the validation loss values of the bigger network, and the crosses are the initial network. The bigger network starts overfitting almost immediately, after just one epoch, and it overfits much more severely. Its validation loss is also noisier. Meanwhile, Figure 4.6 shows the training losses for the two networks. As you can see, the bigger network gets its training loss near zero very quickly. The more capacity the network has, the more quickly it can model the training data, resulting in a low training loss. But the more susceptible it is to overfitting, resulting in a large difference between the training and validation loss. Section 4.4.2. Adding weight regularization. You may be familiar with the principle of Occam's razor. Given two explanations for something, the explanation most likely to be correct is the simplest one, the one that makes fewer assumptions. This idea also applies to the models learned by neural networks. Given some training data and a network architecture, multiple sets of weight values, multiple models, could explain the data. Simpler models are less likely to overfit than complex ones. A simple model in this context is a model where the distribution of parameter values has less entropy, or a model with fewer parameters, as you saw in the previous section. Thus, a common way to mitigate overfitting is to put constraints on the complexity of a network by forcing its weights to take only small values, which makes the distribution of weight values more regular. This is called weight regularization. And it's done by adding to the loss function of the network a cost associated with having large weights. This cost comes in two flavors. L1 regularization. The cost added is proportional to the absolute value of the weight coefficients, the L1 norm of the weights. L2 regularization. The cost added is proportional to the square of the value of the weight coefficients, the L2 norm of the weights. L2 regularization is also called weight decay in the context of neural networks. Don't let the different name confuse you. Weight decay is mathematically the same as L2 regularization. In Keras, weight regularization is added by passing weight regularizer instances to layers as keyword arguments. Let's add L2 weight regularization to the movie review classification network. L2 brackets 0.001 means every coefficient in the weight matrix of the layer will add 0.001 times weight_coefficient_value to the total loss of the network. Note that because this penalty is only added at training time, the loss for this network would be much higher at training than at test time. Figure 4.7 shows the impact of the L2 regularization penalty. As you can see, the model with L2 regularization, dots, has become much more resistant to overfitting than the reference model, crosses, even though both models have the same number of parameters. As an alternative to L2 regularization, you can use one of the following Keras weight regularizers. Section 4.4.3. Adding dropout. Dropout is one of the most effective and most commonly used regularization techniques for neural networks, developed by Jeff Hinton and his students at the University of Toronto. Dropout, applied to a layer, consists of randomly dropping out, setting to zero, a number of output features of the layer during training. Let's say a given layer would normally return a vector 0.2, 0.5, 1.3, 0.8, 1.1, for a given input sample during training. After applying dropout, this vector will have a few zero entries distributed at random, for example 0, 0.5, 1.3, 0, 1.1. The dropout rate is a fraction of the features that are zeroed out. It's usually set between 0.2 and 0.5. At test time, no units are dropped out. Instead, the layer's output values are scaled down by a factor equal to the dropout rate, to balance for the fact that more units are active than at training time. Consider a NumPy matrix containing the output of a layer, layer_output, of shape, batch size by features. At training time, we zero out at random a fraction of the values in the matrix. At test time, we scale down the output by the dropout rate. Here we scale by 0.5 because we previously dropped half the units. Note that this process can be implemented by doing both operations at training time and leaving the output unchanged at test time, which is often the way it's implemented in practice. See Figure 4.8. This technique may seem strange and arbitrary. Why would this help reduce overfitting? Hinton says he was inspired by, among other things, a fraud prevention mechanism used by banks. In his own words, "I went to my bank, the tellers kept changing, and I asked one of them why. He said he didn't know, but they got moved around a lot. I figured it must be because it would require cooperation between employees to successfully defraud the bank. This made me realize that randomly removing a different subset of neurons on each example would prevent conspiracies and thus reduce overfitting. The core idea is that introducing noise in the output values of a layer can break up happenstance patterns that aren't significant, what Hinton refers to as conspiracies, which the network will start memorizing if no noise is present. Footnote. See the Reddit thread, AMA. We are the Google Brain Team. We love to answer your questions about machine learning. At this URL. In Keras, you can introduce dropout in a network via the dropout layer, which is applied to the output of the layer right before it. Let's add two dropout layers in the IMDB network to see how well they do at reducing overfitting. Figure 4.9 shows a plot of the results. Again, this is a clear improvement over the reference network. To recap, these are the most common ways to prevent overfitting in neural networks. Get more training data. Reduce the capacity of the network. Add weight regularization. Add dropout. Section 4.5. The universal workflow of machine learning. In this section, we'll present a universal blueprint that you can use to attack and solve any machine learning problem. The blueprint ties together the concepts you've learned about in this chapter: problem definition, evaluation, feature engineering, and fighting overfitting. Section 4.5.1. Defining the problem and assembling a dataset. First, you must define the problem at hand. What will your input data be? What are you trying to predict? You can only learn to predict something if you have available training data. For example, you can only learn to classify the sentiment of movie reviews if you have both movie reviews and sentiment annotations available. As such, data availability is usually the limiting factor at this stage, unless you have the means to pay people to collect data for you. What type of problem are you facing? Is it binary classification? Multi-class classification? Scalar regression, vector regression, multi-class, multi-label classification. Something else, like clustering, generation, or reinforcement learning. Identifying the problem type will guide your choice of model architecture, loss function, and so on. You can't move to the next stage unless you know what your inputs and outputs are, and what data you'll use. Be aware of the hypotheses you make at this stage. You hypothesize that your outputs can be predicted given your inputs. You hypothesize that your available data is sufficiently informative to learn the relationship between inputs and outputs. Until you have a working model, these are merely hypotheses waiting to be validated or invalidated. Not all problems can be solved. Just because you've assembled examples of input X and targets Y doesn't mean X contains enough information to predict Y. For instance, if you're trying to predict the movement of a stock on the stock market given its recent price history, you're unlikely to succeed because price history doesn't contain much predictive information. One class of unsolvable problems you should be aware of is non-stationary problems. Suppose you're trying to build a recommendation engine for clothing. You're training it on 1 month of data, August, and you want to start generating recommendations in the winter. One big issue is that the kinds of clothes people buy change from season to season. Clothes buying is a non-stationary phenomena over the scale of a few months. What you're trying to model changes over time. In this case, the right move is to constantly retrain your model on data from the recent past, or gather data at a timescale where the problem is stationary. For cyclic problems like clothes buying, a few years' worth of data will suffice to capture seasonal variation. But remember to make the time of year an input of your model. Keep in mind that machine learning can only be used to memorize patterns that are present in your training data. You can only recognize what you've seen before. Using machine learning trained on past data to predict the future is making the assumption that the future will behave like the past. That often isn't the case. Section 4.5.2. Choosing a measure of success. To control something, you need to be able to observe it. To achieve success, you must define what you mean by success. Accuracy. Precision and recall. Customer retention rate. Your metric for success will guide the choice of a loss function. What your model will optimize. It should directly align with your higher level goals, such as the success of your business. For balanced classification problems, where every class is equally likely, accuracy and area under the receiver operating characteristic curve, ROC-AUC, are common metrics. For class imbalance problems, you can use precision and recall. For ranking problems or multi-label classification, you can use mean average precision. And it isn't uncommon to have to define your own custom metric by which to measure success. To get a sense of the diversity of machine learning success metrics and how they relate to different problem domains, it's helpful to browse the data science competitions on Kaggle. See this URL. They showcase a wide range of problems and evaluation metrics. Section 4.5.3. Deciding on an evaluation protocol. Once you know what you're aiming for, you must establish how you'll measure your current progress. We've previously reviewed three common evaluation protocols. Maintaining a holdout validation set. The way to go when you have plenty of data. Doing k-fold cross-validation. The right choice when you have too few samples for holdout validation to be reliable. Doing iterated k-fold validation. For performing highly accurate model evaluation when little data is available. Just pick one of these. In most cases, the first will work well enough. Section 4.5.4. Preparing your data. Once you know what you're training on, what you're optimizing for, and how to evaluate your approach, you're almost ready to begin training models. But first, you should format your data in a way that can be fed into a machine learning model. Here we'll assume a deep neural network. As you saw previously, your data should be formatted as tensors. The values taken by these tensors should usually be scaled to small values, for example in the -1 to 1 range or 0 to 1 range. If different features take values in different ranges, heterogeneous data, then the data should be normalized. You may want to do some feature engineering, especially for small data problems. Once your tensors of input data and target data are ready, you can begin to train models. Section 4.5.5. Developing a model that does better than a baseline. Your goal at this stage is to achieve statistical power. That is, to develop a small model that is capable of beating a dumb baseline. In the MNIST digit classification example, anything that achieves an accuracy greater than 0.1 can be said to have statistical power. In the IMDb example, it's anything with an accuracy greater than 0.5. Note that it's not always possible to achieve statistical power. If you can't beat a random baseline after trying multiple reasonable architectures, it may be that the answer to the question you're asking isn't present in the input data. Remember that you make two hypotheses. You hypothesize that your outputs can be predicted given your inputs. You hypothesize that the available data is sufficiently informative to learn the relationship between inputs and outputs. It may well be that these hypotheses are false, in which case you must go back to the drawing board. Assuming that things go well, you need to make three key choices to build your first working model. Last layer activation. This establishes useful constraints on the network's output. For instance, the IMDb classification example used sigmoid in the last layer. The regression example didn't use any last layer activation, and so on. Loss function. This should match the type of problem you're trying to solve. For instance, the IMDb example used binary underscore cross entropy. The regression example used MSE, and so on. Optimization configuration. What optimizer will you use? What will its learning rate be? In most cases, it's safe to go with RMS prop and its default learning rate. Regarding the choice of a loss function, note that it isn't always possible to directly optimize for the metric that measures success on a problem. Sometimes there is no easy way to turn a metric into a loss function. Loss functions, after all, need to be computable given only a mini batch of data. Ideally, a loss function should be computable for as little as a single data point and must be differentiable. Otherwise, you can't use backpropagation to train your network. For instance, the widely used classification metric ROC-AUC can't be directly optimized. Hence, in classification tasks, it's common to optimize for a proxy metric of ROC-AUC, such as cross-entropy. In general, you can hope that the lower the cross-entropy gets, the higher the ROC-AUC will be. Table 4.1 can help you choose a last layer activation and a loss function for a few common problem types. Section 4.5.6. Scaling up. Developing a model that overfits. Once you've obtained a model that has statistical power, the question becomes, is your model sufficiently powerful? Does it have enough layers and parameters to properly model the problem at hand? For instance, a network with a single hidden layer with two units would have statistical power on MNIST, but wouldn't be sufficient to solve the problem well. Remember that the universal tension in machine learning is between optimization and generalization. The ideal model is one that stands right at the border between underfitting and overfitting, between undercapacity and overcapacity. To figure out where this border lies, first you must cross it. To figure out how big a model you'll need, you must develop a model that overfits. This is fairly easy. Add layers. Make the layers bigger. Train for more epochs. Always monitor the training loss and validation loss, as well as the training and validation values for any metrics you care about. When you see that the model's performance on the validation data begins to degrade, you've achieved overfitting. The next stage is to start regularizing and tuning the model to get as close as possible to the ideal model that neither underfits nor overfits. Section 4.5.7. Regularizing your model and tuning your hyperparameters. This step will take the most time. You'll repeatedly modify your model, train it, evaluate on your validation data, not the test data at this point, modify it again, and repeat until the model is as good as it can get. These are some things you should try. Add dropout. Try different architectures. Add or remove layers. Add L1 and or L2 regularization. Try different hyperparameters, such as the number of units per layer or the learning rate of the optimizer to find the optimal configuration. Optionally, iterate on feature engineering. Add new features or remove features that don't seem to be informative. Be mindful of the following. Every time you use feedback from your validation process to tune your model, you leak information about the validation process into the model. Repeated just a few times, this is innocuous. But done systematically over many iterations, it will eventually cause your model to overfit to the validation process, even though no model is directly trained on any of the validation data. This makes the evaluation process less reliable. Once you've developed a satisfactory model configuration, you can train your final production model on all the available data, training and validation, and evaluate it one last time on the test set. If it turns out that performance on the test set is significantly worse than the performance measured on the validation data, this may mean either that your validation procedure wasn't reliable after all, or that you began overfitting to the validation data while tuning the parameters of the model. In this case, you may want to switch to a more reliable evaluation protocol, such as iterated k-fold validation. Chapter summary. Define the problem at hand and the data on which you'll train. Collect this data, or annotate it with labels if need be. Choose how you'll measure success on your problem. Which metrics will you monitor on your validation data? Determine your evaluation protocol. Holdout validation? K-fold validation? Which portion of the data should you use for validation? Develop a first model that does better than the basic baseline, a model with statistical power. Develop a model that overfits. Regularize your model and tune its hyperparameters based on performance on the validation data. A lot of machine learning research tends to focus only on this step, but keep the big picture in mind. Part 2. Deep Learning in Practice. Chapters 5 to 9 will help you gain practical intuition about how to solve real-world problems using deep learning and will familiarize you with essential deep learning best practices. Most of the code examples in the book are concentrated in this second half. Chapter 5. Deep Learning for Computer Vision. This chapter covers understanding convolutional neural networks, ConvNets, using data augmentation to mitigate overfitting, using a pre-trained ConvNet to do feature extraction, fine-tuning a pre-trained ConvNet, visualizing what ConvNets learn and how they make classification decisions. This chapter introduces convolutional neural networks, also known as ConvNets, a type of deep learning model almost universally used in computer vision applications. You'll learn to apply ConvNet to image classification problems, in particular those involving small training datasets, which are the most common use case if you aren't a large tech company. Section 5.1. Introduction to ConvNets. We're about to dive into the theory of what ConvNets are and why they have been so successful at computer vision tasks. But first, let's take a practical look at a simple ConvNet example. It uses a ConvNet to classify MNIST digits, a task we performed in Chapter 2 using a densely connected network. Our test accuracy then was 97.8%. Even though the ConvNet will be basic, its accuracy will blow out of the water that of the densely connected model from Chapter 2. The following lines of code show you what a basic ConvNet looks like. It's a stack of Conv2D and MaxPooling2D layers. You'll see in a minute exactly what they do. Importantly, a ConvNet takes as input tensors of shape image underscore height by image underscore width by image underscore channels, not including the batch dimension. In this case, we'll configure the ConvNet to process inputs of size 28 by 28 by 1, which is the format of MNIST images. We'll do this by passing the argument input underscore shape, like this, to the first layer. Let's display the architecture of the ConvNet so far. You can see that the output of every Conv2D and MaxPooling2D layer is a 3D tensor of shape height by width by channels. The width and height dimensions tend to shrink as you go deeper in the network. The number of channels is controlled by the first argument passed to the Conv2D layers, 32 or 64. The next step is to feed the last output tensor of shape 3x3x64 into a densely connected classifier network like those you're already familiar with, a stack of dense layers. These classifiers process vectors, which are 1D, whereas the current output is a 3D tensor. First, we have to flatten the 3D outputs to 1D and then add a few dense layers on top. We'll do 10-way classification, using a final layer with 10 outputs and a softmax activation. Here's what the network looks like now. As you can see, the 3x3x64 outputs are flattened into vectors of shape 576, one dimension, before going through two dense layers. Now, let's train the ConvNet on the MNIST digits. We'll reuse a lot of the code from the MNIST example in Chapter 2. Let's evaluate the model on the test data. Whereas the densely connected network from Chapter 2 had a test accuracy of 97.8%, the basic ConvNet has a test accuracy of 99.3%. We decreased the error rate by 68% relative. Not bad. But why does this simple ConvNet work so well compared to a densely connected model? To answer this, let's dive into what the Conv2D and Max Pooling 2D layers do. Section 5.1.1. The convolution operation. The fundamental difference between a densely connected layer and a convolution layer is this. Dense layers learn global patterns in their input feature space. For example, for an MNIST digit, patterns involving all pixels, whereas convolution layers learn local patterns. See Figure 5.1. In the case of images, patterns found in small 2D windows of the inputs. In the previous example, these windows were all 3x3. This key characteristic gives ConvNets two interesting properties. The patterns they learn are translation invariant. After learning a certain pattern in the lower right corner of a picture, a ConvNet can recognize it anywhere, for example, in the upper left corner. A densely connected network would have to learn the pattern anew if it appeared at a new location. This makes ConvNets data efficient when processing images, because the visual world is fundamentally translation invariant. They need fewer training samples to learn representations that have generalization power. They can learn spatial hierarchies of patterns. See Figure 5.2. A first convolution layer will learn small local patterns, such as edges. A second convolution layer will learn larger patterns, made of features of the first layers, and so on. This allows ConvNets to efficiently learn increasingly complex and abstract visual concepts, because the visual world is fundamentally spatially hierarchical. Convolutions operate over 3D tensors called feature maps, with two spatial axes, height and width, as well as a depth axis, also called the channels axis. For an RGB image, the dimension of the depth axis is 3, because the image has 3 color channels, red, green and blue. For a black and white picture, like the MNIST digits, the depth is 1, levels of gray. The convolution operation extracts patches from its input feature map and applies the same transformation to all of these patches, producing an output feature map. This output feature map is still a 3D tensor. It has a width and height. Its depth can be arbitrary, because the output depth is a parameter of the layer, and the different channels in that depth axis no longer stand for specific colors, as in RGB input. Rather, they stand for filters. Filters encode specific aspects of the input data. At a high level, a single filter could encode the concept presence of a face in the input, for instance. In the MNIST example, the first convolution layer takes a feature map of size 28x28x1 and outputs a feature map of size 26x26x32. It computes 32 filters over its input. Each of these 32 output channels contains a 26x26 grid of values, which is a response map of the filter over the input, indicating the response of that filter pattern at different locations in the input. See Figure 5.3. That is what the term feature map means. Every dimension in the depth axis is a feature or filter. And the 2D tensor output, all rows, all columns and n, is the 2D spatial map of the response of this filter over the input. Convolutions are defined by two key parameters. size of the patches extracted from the inputs. These are typically 3x3 or 5x5. In the example, they were 3x3, which is a common choice. Depth of the output feature map. The number of filters computed by the convolution. The example started with a depth of 32 and ended with a depth of 64. In Keras common 2D layers, these parameters are the first arguments passed to the layer. Like this. A convolution works by sliding these windows of size 3x3 or 5x5 over the 3D input feature map, stopping at every possible location and extracting the 3D patch of surrounding features. Shape, window underscore height, by window underscore width, by input depth. Each such 3D patch is then transformed via a tensor product with the same learned weight matrix called the convolution kernel into a 1D vector of shape, output underscore depth. All of these vectors are then spatially reassembled into a 3D output map of shape, height, by width, by output underscore depth. Every spatial location in the output feature map corresponds to the same location in the input feature map. For example, the lower right corner of the output contains information about the lower right corner of the input. For instance, with 3x3 windows, the vector output, like this, comes from the 3D patch, like this. The full process is detailed in Figure 5.4. Note that the output width and height may differ from the input width and height. They may differ for two reasons. Border effects, which can be countered by padding the input feature map. The use of strides, which I'll define in a second. Let's take a deeper look at these notions. Understanding border effects and padding. Consider a 5x5 feature map, 25 tiles total. There are only 9 tiles around which you can center a 3x3 window, forming a 3x3 grid. See Figure 5.5. Hence the output feature map will be 3x3. It shrinks a little, by exactly 2 tiles along each dimension in this case. You can see this border effect in action in the earlier example. You start with 28x28 inputs, which become 26x26 after the first convolution layer. If you want to get an output feature map with the same spatial dimensions as the input, you can use padding. Padding consists of adding an appropriate number of rows and columns on each side of the input feature map so as to make it possible to fit center convolution windows around every input tile. For a 3x3 window, you add one column on the right, one column on the left, one row at the top, and one row at the bottom. For a 5x5 window, you add 2 rows. See Figure 5.6. In Conv2D layers, padding is configurable via the padding argument, which takes 2 values. Valid, which means no padding, only valid locations will be used, and same, which means pad in such a way as to have an output with the same width and height as the input. The padding argument defaults to valid. Understanding convolution strides. The other factor that can influence output size is the notion of strides. The description of convolution so far has assumed that the center tiles of the convolution windows are all contiguous. But the distance between 2 successive windows is a parameter of the convolution called its stride, which defaults to 1. It's possible to have strided convolutions, a convolution with a stride higher than 1. In Figure 5.7, you can see the patches extracted by a 3x3 convolution with stride 2 over a 5x5 input, without padding. Using stride 2 means the width and height of the feature map are downsampled by a factor of 2, in addition to any changes induced by border effects. Strided convolutions are rarely used in practice, although they can come in handy for some types of models. It's good to be familiar with the concept. To downsample feature maps, instead of strides, we tend to use the max pooling operation, which you saw in action in the first ConvNet example. Let's look at it in more depth. Section 5.1.2. The max pooling operation. In the ConvNet example, you may have noticed that the size of the feature maps is halved after every max pooling 2D layer. For instance, before the first Max Pooling 2D layer, the feature map is 26 by 26. But the Max Pooling operation halves it to 13 by 13. That's the role of Max Pooling, to aggressively downsample feature maps, much like strided convolutions. Max Pooling consists of extracting windows from the input feature maps and outputting the max value of each channel. It's conceptually similar to convolution, except that instead of transforming local patches via a learned linear transformation, the convolution kernel, they're transformed via a hard-coded max tensor operation. A big difference from convolution is that max pooling is usually done with 2x2 windows and stride 2 in order to downsample the feature map by a factor of 2. On the other hand, convolution is typically done with 3x3 windows and no stride, stride 1. Why downsample feature maps this way? Why not remove the max pooling layers and keep fairly large feature maps all the way up? Let's look at this option. The convolutional base of the model would then look like this. Here's a summary of the model. What's wrong with this setup? Two things. It isn't conducive to learning a spatial hierarchy of features. The 3x3 windows in the third layer will only contain information coming from 7x7 windows in the initial input. The high-level patterns learned by the ConvNet will still be very small with regard to the initial input, which may not be enough to learn to classify digits. Try recognizing a digit by only looking at it through windows that are 7x7 pixels. We need the features from the last convolution layer to contain information about the totality of the input. The final feature map has 22x22x64, that equals 30,976, total coefficients per sample. This is huge. If you were to flatten it to stick a dense layer of size 512 on top, that layer would have 15.8 million parameters. This is far too large for such a small model and would result in intense overfitting. In short, the reason to use downsampling is to reduce the number of feature map coefficients to process, as well as to induce spatial filter hierarchies by making successive convolution layers look at increasingly large windows in terms of the fraction of the original input they cover. Note that max pooling isn't the only way you can achieve such downsampling. As you already know, you can also use strides in the prior convolution layer. And you can use average pooling instead of max pooling, where each local input patch is transformed by taking the average value of each channel over the patch, rather than the max. But max pooling tends to work better than these alternative solutions. In a nutshell, the reason is that features tend to encode the spatial presence of some pattern or concept over the different tiles of the feature map, hence the term feature map. And it's more informative to look at the maximal presence of different features than at their average presence. So the most reasonable subsampling strategy is to first produce dense maps of features via unstrided convolutions, and then look at the maximal activation of the features over small patches, rather than looking at sparser windows of the inputs via strided convolutions, or averaging input patches, which could cause you to miss or dilute feature presence information. At this point, you should understand the basics of ConvNets. Feature maps, convolution, and max pooling. And you know how to build a small ConvNet to solve a toy problem such as MNIST digits classification. Now let's move on to more useful, practical applications. Section 5.2. Training a ConvNet from scratch on a small dataset. Having to train an image classification model using very little data is a common situation, which you'll likely encounter in practice if you ever do computer vision in a professional context. A few samples can mean anywhere from a few hundred to a few tens of thousands of images. As a practical example, we'll focus on classifying images as dogs or cats in a dataset containing 4,000 pictures of cats and dogs, 2,000 cats, 2,000 dogs. We'll use 2,000 pictures for training, 1,000 for validation, and 1,000 for testing. In this section, we'll review one basic strategy to tackle this problem: training a new model from scratch using what little data you have. You'll start by naively training a small ConvNet on the 2,000 training samples without any regularization to set a baseline for what can be achieved. This will get you to a classification accuracy of 71%. At that point, the main issue will be overfitting. Then we'll introduce data augmentation, a powerful technique for mitigating overfitting in computer vision. By using data augmentation, you'll improve the network to reach an accuracy of 82%. In the next section, we'll review two more essential techniques for applying deep learning to small datasets: feature extraction with a pre-trained network, which will get you to an accuracy of 90 to 96%, and fine-tuning a pre-trained network. This will get you to a final accuracy of 97%. Together, these three strategies, training a small model from scratch, doing feature extraction using a pre-trained model, and fine-tuning a pre-trained model, will constitute your future toolbox for tackling the problem of performing image classification with small datasets. Section 5.2.1. The relevance of deep learning for small data problems. You'll sometimes hear that deep learning only works when lots of data is available. This is valid in part. One fundamental character